Good evening. I want to talk a little bit before we go to Dogen about next Tuesday night, because we're going to celebrate the Hungry Ghost or ceremony or the Gate of Sweet Dew. Some of you participated in the last couple of years. We do it in the back room at the round table. We bring food, cooked food, sweet food, fruits, vegetables, and create a kind of groaning board of generosity for all beings. It's kind of the Buddhist version of Halloween, where the separation between worlds becomes thinner at this time of year. Many, many different traditions do this, understand things in this way. As the days get shorter and the trees begin to shed their leaves, the veil between worlds becomes thinner and thinner. Halloween is a celebration of that. The Day of the Dead in Mexico is a celebration of it. And this Gate of Sweet Dew ceremony also, where we create a whole table full of food and then invite everything that's out there to come in and feast and be satisfied. One of the basic teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha and of all Buddhism is how terribly unsatisfied beings are. That the essence of our suffering is our dissatisfaction. And so this is a kind of exercise in generosity and loving kindness to say to all beings, all the suffering beings, please come, please eat, please be satisfied. So there's a little bit of chanting to do. There's a little recitation to do, and we don't offer incense because the Quakers don't let us, but we have potpourri that we can offer instead to create a beautiful smell. Many flowers, we'll have many flowers, and we'll chant the Heart Sutra and the Gate of Sweet Dew as we offer incense or the potpourri. At the end, we close the gate, and then we feast. So it turns into a party at the end. One essential part of it is a list that's read of the people we know who have died during the year. So if you have relatives and friends who can be on that list, tell Donna Lynn. She's going to be the one to recite that list. It's a very touching ceremony. It's hard to describe how it feels. But we're all in this life and death exercise together. We all suffer loss. We all suffer the suffering of dissatisfaction of every different kind. And we also have a very warm and generous feeling about all beings. So this is an exercise in recognizing how things are and also exercising some kind of way of recognizing and enacting what we feel and what we know. We have a new element of it this year, and that is to bring canned goods as well as things that we can eat. and those will go to Second Harvest. There's a dearth of food for everyone out there this year. Salvation Army, Second Harvest, all the food banks are really sparse this year. So if we all bring some things to contribute that way, we're actually reaching out into our own world, our own place. This is a wonderful opportunity for that. So I hope everybody comes. I hope it goes out on the listserv too, with a kind of description so people know to. We'll come here first to sit. The first 40 minutes we'll sit, and then we'll go to the back room and do everything in the back room from then on. Well, we're in book 2, believe it or not. Page 28. You want to begin?
Yes, if you
have a question. Oh, okay.
Book 2, he instructed. If the wayfarer first just subdues his mind, it will be easy to abandon his body and the world as well. But if he thinks of others' views in respect to his speech and behavior, and refrains from doing something because people would think ill of it as a bad thing, or if he tries to do good when the opportunity arises, because if he did this thing, others would look upon him as a true Buddhist, these are still worldly feelings. But if one therefore selfishly follows his own will and does bad things, he is a wholly evil man.
The point is to forget evil intention, forget one's own body, and just act wholly for the sake of the Buddha way. One must be mindful in all events. For beginners in practice, even though they be worldly feelings, though they be human feelings, to subdue evil in the mind and practice good in the body is none other than abandoning the body and mind.
It's a strange thing to say, that last bit. To subdue evil in the mind and practice good in the body is none other than abandonment of body and mind. I often talk about how when I first heard about Zen, there was no talk about good and evil at all. There was no talk about the precepts at all. It was about meditation and about whatever people thought meditation was. Kobin was one of the very first teachers to bring up the precepts and emphasize them. And of course, the first precept, the pure precepts, are to stop evil and practice good, and save the many beings. We like to think that we can practice hard enough that we're not going to even go there as far as evil is concerned. But the mind is the mind. I don't know how it works exactly, but it's it's a kind of wild place. And it takes careful attention to it. Buddha talks in the Satipatthana Sutra about being ardent and fully aware. Ardent and fully aware of what one is thinking. Though I do think as Zen students we try awfully hard to be good. Too hard sometimes, I think. Maybe we should break a rule here and there and kind of tweak things a little bit, but only because we're so truly sincere. I think once we find ourselves on a cushion, having been found here, even not knowing how we got here, that our desire for what we could call good, the good, or the truth, is what lives us and inspires us. It's certainly a body practice, and practicing good in the body is about the only place it's possible. We can think ourselves in many different directions, but this is the doing of it. This is the action. I remember when we first began to sit Zen at Haiku Zendo, and there was a lot of posturing going on. It's very impressive to get involved with a Zen group, and this was a real Zendo, a very simple little suburban Zendo in a garage that had been transformed. But it was beautiful wood, very plain. And it was built up so that the cushions were up about this high on a ton all the way around. 17 cushions for the 17. Haiku phrases. And a little altar that Suzuki Roshi had created. Just a shelf with a Buddha on it. And it was pretty impressive to be there, and pretty impressive to think of oneself as being a Zen student. And there was a lot of goings on about that. I think he's pointing to that in here when he talks about how people think about oneself, being self-conscious about how it looks from the outside. Do I look like a Zen student? Do people get it? Does it make me important? It doesn't last, of course. Or there's the other way, which is to completely hide one's practice and just never tell. That's what happened to me. I loved sitting, and I went to Haiku Zendo, but then I would tiptoe out as fast as I could when it was over, and then go home and never tell anybody what I was doing. Not for years. So when you read these and hear them, you can think he was talking to particular people. And I bet there were people who were really excited about being monks and really wanted to kind of show off a little bit. And he isn't harsh with them at all. He just says, take it easy. Shall we go on? The questions about this? Julian?
I'd be interested to hear more of your thoughts about, talking about your practice or not talking about it with people in your life, that kind of thing, and how it could affect your practice.
I don't think there's any rule at all. It really depends on who you're talking to or who you might talk to if you got to that point. I used to think that everybody would be shocked and horrified the way my husband was when I first started to sit, because he thought I'd fallen into a cult, and he was really disturbed by the whole idea of it. But then much later I realized that most people didn't think that way, and that it wasn't so threatening to people, and that Zen, even though people didn't completely understand what Zen was, they knew it was meditation. So, and that has a good reputation. You know, meditation is pretty innocent, and people just think you're really amazingly strong to be able to sit. And usually they say, oh, I couldn't do that myself, but, you know, it's fabulous that you can do that. So it just depends on who you're talking to. You know, to proselytize is a big mistake. You know, if you go and take somebody, oh, you've got to do this, this is a fabulous practice, you know, it will do you all such good, it will make everything all better. That's a lie, and it doesn't help. But you can offer whatever is inquired of you. Now, if somebody asks, you can say.
It's kind of weird, the kind of relationship, like the kind of images people have of the practice. And
yes.
I guess a concern is it's another kind of barrier.
It can be. It can be. If people think it's a really strange thing. But then there's you. There's the real you. So better to be the real you and not talk about the ideas about something that people don't even understand. You know, just be yourself. And that comes through. Your practice comes through as you yourself. That's the best explanation of all.
I remember, related to that, I think it was Half the Cart who wrote that. Was that Goldstein or Cornfield? I forget.
It's Cornfield.
And I think it was that book that he wrote when he came back from Burma or India. He had his head shaven and barefoot. Is it that
Yeah. Thing
I'm going to say? And he had his robes on and he'd walk around in New York City or whatever, you know. And, you know, everybody would just be staring at him, saying, what a weirdo and everything. And he wanted to talk about being a Buddhist and everything. And nobody wanted to talk to him about it. You know, he was like, gosh, here's this freak. Something like when he took the robes off, he said, oh, it's much better. I was much better Buddhist when I took my robes off. Something like that. Because essentially he was then himself. He wasn't costumed up and trying to be what he was doing is, like you said, like a barrier or alienating.
Yeah.
In a sense. You remember this.
Yeah. And showing off.
Yeah.
And of course people feel that, you know, it's just totally fake.
Yeah.
I'm working with a young man who's a body worker, and he doesn't know anything about this practice, but I had to tell him what I do because that has something to do with how we do things. And I told him today that I sat all day Saturday. You did? All day? How many hours? He was just amazed. And he said, you must have been exhausted at the end. I said, no, you feel like you can leap tall buildings with a single bound. You come out feeling fresh and new. I think that kind of, you know, if people are curious, then we can share. But only as far as they ask. And no farther than that. It's tricky.
Weird how, like, people, it's almost that action of, no, I could never do
yes.
that. It's that, I don't know, that it's, I don't yeah. know how to respond to that, or, because it doesn't seem that big a deal, really, in certain ways. I don't know.
Like, yeah, people have all kinds of ideas. Jane?
And then there's back east. I'm going to my family at Christmas time, and it's different back east. Maybe especially in my family in Toronto, that there's a suspicion of Eastern, I mean Far East practices. And so I remember last time I was there, my cousin asked me, "So you're Buddhist, eh?" And, I mean, there's a question right there. So I kind of like try and deflect it because I know there's a whole thing behind that. And he just says, so I guess you don't drink or eat meat. I felt like it was, and I do both. So at that point, it was, I think, about maybe disappointed idealism on her part or she's trying to see if this for real and so it is a lot about where the other person is coming from when they ask you that question and to kind of sidestep my own anxiety about being truthful or irritated or whatever it is tricky and funny too.
Yes you meet everybody's suppositions and prejudices.
Yeah. That same lines. It's not necessarily negative. It's like this higher standard too. Oh, you're Buddhist or you're Zen, so you must never get mad.
Yes.
All these this higher standard that you can't make mistakes. And,
right.
You know.
Or cuss.
Yeah.
Pure. Totally
or
pure.
Get stressed out.
Yeah. I was told, I said, and I wasn't even cussing or anything. Whatever I said apparently was not Buddhist. There are issues there.
Not nobody else.
Yeah.
Well, my kids used to do that. They would get mad at me and say, "You're not acting like a Buddhist." All right, already.
Well, yeah, and then I was supposed to take yoga too. Well, yes, I do. I'm sure you do. Hot tub, well, yes.
You're just jealous.
Somebody asked me what, I said, oh, Zha Zen. So, I know what Zen is, but what Zha? And then I wasn't sure what Zen is.
I didn't say I know what Zen is. This person said I know what Zen is. And I thought, oh, you do? Okay, what is it?
Za means sitting.
And so what does Zen mean?
Meditation.
So we say Zen Buddhism, meditation Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like swimming? I mean,
no, there's chanting Buddhism. There's monks Buddhism. There's walking meditation. There are many different ways of doing this. So Zazen is sitting meditation. And, you know, Dogen says several times that if you call yourself a Buddhist, you should wash your mouth out with soap. Because it creates a separation you're talking about. So it's sometimes I think we need to be Buddhists. I mean, we need to say so. But often it just gets in the way. And then people want to argue with you. They want to bring up another religion and compare it or try to make it. And all of that isn't what Buddhism is anyway. I mean, our Zazen practice can't really be discussed in that way. You can sit down with someone and be quiet for a long time and then talk in that mutual situation where you're both experiencing the same thing, but otherwise it's just noise. And of course it's being developed all along in America. We're creating our own language for it, our own new language in America. And trying to develop new ways that aren't Japanese. But in the course of that, sometimes it becomes a very thoughty thing, a very figured out and artificial kind of structure, rather than just the grounded, actual embodied activity of Zazen. Sitting meditation itself. Kodo Sawaki was Koban's first sitting master, and that was his whole emphasis, because in Japan, Zazen had almost disappeared. When people went to the monastery, they learned to sit, they were made to sit, and they hated it. And then when they left the monastery to go and take over a temple somewhere, they swore, still to this day, many of them, swear never to sit on a cushion again. Ever. So there's always that side of things, that kind of easy distortion that can happen. So Kodo Sawaki just emphasized Zazen only, just Zazen itself. And people thought he was very strange. He was kind of off the wall. And he was a very funny man, very charismatic. But it turned things. It turned things and changed things a lot. And he had two very famous students, one of whom was Koban, and the other was Deshi Maru, who became the Bishop of Europe. So we've inherited a kind of offbeat return to fundamentals, you could say, in our practice, in our tradition with Koban. Which is a good thing and a hard thing. In a way, it's harder, I think. But it has great power. So now it's time. Thank you.